You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the EPA is facing scrutiny over efforts to stop the publication of a study on a dangerous drinking water pollutant. We'll get the details. First, the use of force by police nationwide has been in the news for several years, often after fatalities. And many communities have instituted the use of police body cameras, in part in the hopes of preventing incidents from escalating. The Urban Institute recently presented a report to the Milwaukee Police and Fire Commission based on data from 2015 and 2016. The federally funded report looked at whether the use of police body cams in Milwaukee had any effect on the use of force by officers there. Chuck Kornbach covered the release of that report and the meeting of the commission. He's a WPR reporter based in Milwaukee. Chuck, good to have you back.
Thank you, Rob. Hello.
Well, let's talk about what this study found specifically on use of force. What did they find when they compared officers wearing body cams and those not, and how it stacked up over the years?
Well, the Urban Institute, using a federal grant and with cooperation from the Milwaukee Police Department, looked at about 500 officers that wore the body cameras between October 2015 and December 2016. I believe now all 1,100 Milwaukee officers, patrol officers, wear the body cameras. But anyway, they randomly chose about 500, examined arrest records and complaint records, and also interviewed the officers. And the findings were somewhat surprising in that there was no change in the use of force during the study period. However, two other key findings the Urban Institute highlighted. One is that those wearing the body cameras conducted fewer, they call subject stops. These are more pedestrian stops than traffic ones. So fewer subject stops and also less likely to receive a complaint than officers who did not have cameras. Citizen complaints were down, in other words.
As body cameras were instituted in the Milwaukee Police Department, did they say what the hopes were? Were they helpful? Was there the hope that use of force would go down?
Well, like Milwaukee, like other communities, yes, that was one of the hopes. And certainly the momentum for the body cameras went up after the fatal police shooting of Dontre Hamilton in the downtown Milwaukee Park. There had been some testing of the department using body cameras before that, but in 2014, when that incident occurred, there were pressure increased, and by 2015 and 16, the mayor had put enough money in the budget to equip everybody. But the hope was use of force cases would go down, but according to this study, they did not. However, the Urban Institute concluded that, put out a theory that the Milwaukee Police Department, under former Chief Flynn, had decided to use less of force. Less use of force would be a better thing. And so that the researchers saying, well, maybe what we've documented was already a decline in the use of force, and that there wasn't going to go down any further with body cameras.
And then there was this other finding as part of this study that the officers were less likely to be the object of citizen complaints. What did they attribute that to?
Well, something called a civilizing effect. In other words, if you are having an interaction with a police officer, or a police officer is having an interaction with you, and you both know that there's a camera running, maybe you're going to be a little more careful, maybe you're going to hold off on saying certain things and escalating things. So this civilizing effect is credited for, you know, having people sort of cool down because they either weren't going to conduct as many subject stops, the police weren't, or the citizens maybe weren't going to file complaints because they would think, oh, the police have this camera running on me, and I can't really prove what I might be concerned or upset, but I can't really prove that the officer engaged in bad behavior.
Talking to WPR reporter Chuck Kornbach about a new study on Milwaukee's police department using body cameras, the impact that's had on the use of force. Not much, the study finds. Police complaints, that's gone down. What kind of reactions have you been seeing since this data was unveiled, Chuck?
Well, there was discussion at the Fire and Police Commission meeting last Thursday was relatively brief. The officers, the Urban Institute, gave their presentation. There were a few questions from the commissioners, but not a whole lot. So the Milwaukee Police Department body camera coordinator, Doug Warwick eventually came to the microphone and talked about the study.
What this shows is our department, for the most part, is doing the right thing, using the appropriate amount of force in most cases. I think it leads to how well we're being trained. I think it says a lot for also the supervision as well.
And that fits in what you were talking about earlier, Chuck, that maybe it isn't the body cameras, it's just the police policy on use of force that is seeing change over time. Chuck, we seem to have lost the connection with Chuck. We'll see if we can bring him back. Talking to WPR's own Chuck Quirnbach, a reporter out of Milwaukee, about this new study on use of force in Milwaukee. How it's changed or hasn't changed since body cameras are implemented. Sounds like we've got you there, Chuck. I was just asking, I was saying that fit into what you were saying earlier, that comment from Doug Warwick about maybe what we're seeing in use of force trends is change in department policy, not so much anything having to do with the body cams.
That's right, and the Urban Institute also said that that finding and some of the other findings they reached were consistent with some of the other police departments they've studied in the U.S.
And then you also got us some audio from the chairman of the Milwaukee Fire and Police Commission. Can you set that up for us?
Sure. That's from Stephen DeVogus, chair of the Fire and Police Commission. He was pretty happy with the report, but he is saying another report that the department or Fire and Police Commission had recently shows there's been sort of a change in weaponry, if you will.
We just recently had our use of force report issued in 2017, and we saw that there was an over-reliance on tasers. You know, so people stopped using their firearm, but they started using tasers. So hopefully, you know, we keep de-escalating force and only using force as a last resort.
And he's referring there, Chuck, not to this Urban Institute study, but the department's own data looking at, you know, when they use force and how much force is used. Have you dug into those numbers, guns, firearm use by police down, but tasers up?
Well, what has come up instead is some taser and other cases in the Milwaukee area of recent, that, which is going to show a highlight on this. Milwaukee Journal Sentinel is reporting today that there's going to be a video released perhaps this week of the tasing of a Milwaukee Bucks basketball player during a parking lot dispute earlier this year. There was a big taser case involving a fatality in West Milwaukee last year. Came to light more this year when the DA decided not to issue charges against the officers. And there's been some other confrontations in the Milwaukee area between police and citizens, not involving tasers, but just sort of shows the confrontations continue.
And these videos, one way or another, they can be contentious. People are already, with this Milwaukee Bucks incident, it sounds like the police are already reaching out to community members saying, this video, it's going to generate some backlash. So that, apart from what the videos do themselves to police procedure, they can be inflammatory down the road.
Well, yeah, I don't think anybody thought that body cameras would solve these disputes. It provides some additional information, but depending on the angle of the body camera, whether the officers turned it on the body camera when they should have, and so on, it is not going to resolve everything. And there was the case of Dominic Hagen Brown, the officer charged in the Sylville Smith shooting 2 years ago. He was charged, but the jury later acquitted him of criminal charges in the shooting. So it's not going to be all and end all, these cameras.
And briefly, Chuck, as we wrap up, the cameras, whatever the data says, they are there to stay for the time being.
I have not heard of any thought of getting rid of the cameras. There might be some changes on when they're used and how often and so on. But it seems that the more police departments around the state are going to be adding them, unless there's some big controversy that argues against them.
Chuck, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Chuck Quirnbach, WPR reporter in Milwaukee, looking at new research on the use of body cameras by police officers in the city. Right now, lawmakers are criticizing the Environmental Protection Agency after emails showed that it tried to prevent the publication of a report on the dangers of a chemical pollutant. The report focused on the same chemicals that contaminated private wells in the Peshtigo area last December. About 100 homeowners are still being provided bottled water there. Exchanges between the EPA and the White House's budget office show that the effort to keep the study private stemmed from fears of a, quote, public relations nightmare. Michael Halpern is the deputy director of the Center for Science and Democracy, part of the Union of Concerned Scientists. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Before we get into this report in particular, can you tell us about the chemicals that are at the center of this story?
Sure. And we're talking about what really is a growing public health crisis related to what are called PFAS, which is a class of man-made chemicals that is found really throughout the United States that are making people sick. It comes from a lot of different chemical companies like DuPont. A lot of it is legacy pollution that has come from factories, from firefighting foam, and other types of products that have contaminated groundwater all throughout the United States.
And can you talk about where these are localized? I understand a lot of this is on military sites in particular.
You do find that military families are at particular risk, and that's the reason the Defense Department is particularly interested in these chemicals. There has been found a lot of significant contamination around military bases where the chemical was used in firefighting foam for a long time and continues to be in a lot of places. So there are military bases all around the country where they're paying special attention to what levels of this chemical are safe and what are not.
And that's the big question, what levels are safe? And a lot of this report that we're going to get into has to do with the safe levels in drinking water. Prior to this report, what has been the federal guideline? What have we regarded as safe when it comes to these chemicals?
So the EPA a couple years ago set a threshold of 70 parts per trillion that was set up to really be a guideline for agencies around the country. But what we found is that by and large, over the past couple decades, the federal government really hasn't done much related to really controlling these chemicals and cleaning them up. And so states have been stepping in a lot more to take actions and protect public health and the environment.
That brings us to this report now from the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, not a household name, really. Can you talk about this agency and the importance of the reports that it issues?
Yeah, so this is part of the Department of Health and Human Services, where the CDC also lives, and they were ready to come out with a study related to these chemicals that would find harm at considerably lower levels of exposure than the EPA had. Basically, it's the types of methods that they're using to look more holistically at the impact that these types of chemicals would have on all people, including more vulnerable populations. And when the White House got wind of the fact that they were going to come out with this report, the White House reached out to the EPA and the Department of Defense to basically try to figure out a way to shut it down. In emails that were obtained through the Freedom of Information Act, we found that they were openly speculating about the concern that this new study would cause, quote, a PR nightmare for the White House. So there was more interest in controlling the public relations than protecting the public, and so far they've been successful in suppressing the report.
Right. This report still hasn't been released to the public yet, right?
That's correct. And because of the pretty significant bipartisan outrage that has come out over the past couple of weeks since the cover-up was brought to light, and because it affects so many people in red states and blue states, the agency has indicated that it does intend to release the report, and the EPA should be encouraging them to do so, not dissuading them from doing so.
Talking to Michael Halpern with Union of Concerned Scientists about a federal government report on the safety level of a potentially hazardous chemical. Michael, what would have to happen if we put these new guidelines in place? What kind of would there be required remediation around the country if we went with much lower guidelines than it existed previously?
Well, a lot of this is advisory in nature, and it ends up being up to states to set what standards make sense for specific areas. So just this month, actually, over in Minnesota, the state government came out with recommended levels of exposure and also very specific advice on what lakes to fish in and what lakes not to fish in, and what types of fish you could take from specific lakes in the state. And so that is the type of information that people need to make really informed decisions about their own health and safety, and the types of things we need to encourage. So, I mean, if we look at the EPA right now, you know, the EPA leadership is not particularly concerned about chemical exposure, and they we see that because of the fact that of the people that they're nominating to lead these important positions within the agency. There was a longtime chemical industry advocate named Michael Duerson who was nominated by the president to lead chemical safety policy at EPA, and Senate Republicans refused to confirm him because he had been paid by the chemical industry for a number of years to advocate for much looser restrictions on these particular chemicals. Exposure limits that the companies themselves had acknowledged were not safe. So at this point, you know, with the long history at EPA of delay and inaction and not a terribly high willingness to step in and take action, it's really been left up to the states. And the EPA's best role at this point is to provide the resources and technical support that state departments of natural resources need to get the job done, assuming, of course, that those state DNRs have the independence to pursue this kind of work.
Is it that unusual to hold off on releasing a report where you've got one group of scientists in the federal government saying something that's very different than the previous guidelines? Maybe it would make sense to say, hold on, let's compare the science, the judgment used by each group, and then figure out what we want in the public eye?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I don't think that you want confusion in the public. You know, that said, this type of process should not be coming from the White House concerned about public relations nightmares. It should be the scientists working this information out among themselves. And we see on all kinds of different issues, from smoking to exposure to chemicals, that people are pretty good at looking at different types of information and deciding their risk levels. And I think that we should err on the side of releasing information, especially if it suggests that the current safety thresholds are not safe, and then allow the scientists to work that out themselves. You know, this should be a conversation that is taking place among the experts, not among political appointees that have political considerations, not public considerations in mind.
Let's get back to the chemicals themselves. If people are exposed to these, say in their drinking water, at higher than the safe levels, these very low levels of parts per trillion, what kind of health impacts do they have?
So it has been linked to cancer, to thyroid disease, to weakened immune systems, even possibly lowering the effects of vaccines in younger people. And we find that pregnant women are especially vulnerable to these kinds of chemicals and passing along some of passing along some of the damage to developing fetuses and the like. And that's why a lot of states and have started developing standards that are considerably stronger than what the EPA puts at its minimum threshold, because they're looking at all kinds of different vulnerable populations. So over in Minnesota, just like I said, this month, their updated values are currently half of what EPA's value is.
Now, I understand there's a local issue here near Peshtigo, Wisconsin, a test facility run by a fire products company. These chemicals found their way into the groundwater. About 100 families there, I understand, are still being supplied bottled water by the company in question. Is this something that we've seen happen before, specific leaks or outbreak isn't the quite word, but incidents of these chemicals in very high concentrations in waterways?
Yeah, certainly. And that's why, you know, one of the things the EPA really needs to do is to make sure that there is funding available for states to be able to test and clean up drinking water. A lot of the problems here end up being very localized, that has a tremendous impact on communities that need that information and need to make sure that those monitoring resources are in place to make sure that we are able to assess these kinds of threats in a responsible way.
You mentioned earlier the reaction from senators, U.S. senators of both parties, that'll probably lead to this information being released. What do you think about the role of Congress in oversight here?
Well, congressional oversight is extremely important when it comes to looking at how science is used in the federal government. And it's very common for political appointees to want to suppress the kinds of information that is not convenient to the politics at hand. And we've seen that happen with regard to climate change, with regard to invasive or endangered species, and a lot of other areas under the current presidential administration. And so it's encouraging to see Congress step up and send letters and call for this study to be released, but they definitely have to do more. This is the job that Congress was set up to do, is to monitor agencies and making sure that they have sufficient independence from the political leaders who are appointed to head them, and to make sure that scientists are able to share their results publicly, regardless of whether or not those results benefit a particular company or not.
Michael, thanks for joining us today.
It's been great to be with you.
Michael Halpern is the Deputy Director of the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists. He joined us to talk about emails showing the EPA sought to block the release of a report on the dangers of chemical pollutants. First, children are being separated from their parents when families illegally cross the U.S. border. Under the policy, parents can be held by ICE agents and their children can be sent to youth shelters. Administration officials have argued they're simply upholding the law as it stands now, but detractors say it's a method of intimidation and a way to deter people from entering the country, even if they're seeking asylum. Our next guest is here to talk about the precedent for the policy, the legality of the practice, and what it says about the American approach to immigration. Elise Cohen is an assistant professor of political science at UW-Sheboygan and UW-Manitowoc. Elise, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much. Great to be with you.
Now, as I understand it, this specifically isn't a policy that says we will separate parents from children, but that's in effect what's going on at the border as more people are charged with trying to enter the country illegally. Can you talk about how this is working out this year?
Yeah, you're exactly right, Rob. It's being framed as a zero tolerance policy, meaning for immigrants who cross the border illegally, from this point forward, the Trump administration says they will be criminally prosecuting 100% of those illegal border crossing cases. So you're right that it's not being framed as a family separation policy. At the same time, I think the reason it's getting a lot of attention for that aspect is we've had several Trump administration officials, including the White House Chief of Staff, John Kelly, including Attorney General Jeff Sessions, talk about deterrence and how this is really sort of geared at people that may be thinking about crossing the border illegally. Attorney General Sessions said, if you don't want your child separated, don't take them across the border illegally.
And in practice, how is that working? When a kid is separated from their parents as they cross the border, where does the child go?
Yeah, so the initial step would be removing the child from the family or the adults that were accompanying them on the border. They then have about 2 days to transfer them from the ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, to the Department of Health and Human Services. Often the Office of Refugee Resettlement will take custody of the children. They usually will then be taken to shelters. A lot of the shelters are run by nonprofit, non-governmental organizations. But there's really no way, once the children are in the custody of that system, to determine whether they've been separated from someone who was legitimately their parent, or even for reuniting those parents with those children who may have been mistakenly separated from them in that process. The adults will face criminal charges if they're really prosecuting them for illegal entry or reentry, which means the adults would then be taken to jail and detention centers and incarcerated.
I want to compare what's going on now to what's gone on in the recent past. First of all, you said this is a zero tolerance policy, meaning if someone tries to cross the border illegally, they're charged with a crime. What had we been doing at the border in the past in those situations?
Yeah, that's a great question. To give some context to this, I think what's really new about this strategy is the idea that we will be referring all crossings for prosecution in the criminal courts, which means even if the individuals are claiming asylum or have very small children with them, in the past, the Department of Homeland Security would sort of use discretion regarding which cases would be recommended for prosecution. So, for example, asylum seekers that were really claiming a well-founded fear of persecution, harm, or torture, they were often allowed to have their case play out in the immigration courts, which are administrative units rather than the federal criminal courts, before they would be recommended for prosecution, which means they could often be released, living with relatives or being monitored through technology or phone check-ins, but not being detained. Sometimes deportation was used without filing any criminal charges at all, just deporting those people back. And so that's one of the things that's really new here is this idea, first of all, that all the illegal border crossings will be referred for prosecution, you know, with criminal federal charges. And I think the second thing is just the amount of separation that's occurring. I think that I saw some recent reports where we have about 700 children, according to the Office of Refugee Resettlement Data, that have been removed from adults that were accompanying them at the border since October. And I think about 100 of those children are even younger than the age of 4. And we've never seen anything like that in terms of the amount of separation of children.
Talking to Elise Cohen, Assistant Professor of Political Science at UW-Sheboygan and UW-Manitowoc, about U.S. border enforcement policy and a policy that leads to separation of children from their families when they are caught trying to cross the border illegally. Before we dig into more about the kids themselves, Elise, one point that the Trump administration has raised is that, okay, if someone or someone in their family has a legitimate grounds to apply for asylum, why not come in through the legally determined ports of entry, they call them, points of entry into the United States and apply for asylum instead of attempting to cross illegally at a different point?
Yeah, and so that's a great point. Some of these who are being detained actually did go to a port of entry. So it's a little misleading to suggest that they're only detaining those that have entered irregularly, not through the ports of entry. There are also those that don't really understand the port of entry system, so they may not be aware what the port of entry means. That would be like an airport or an official border crossing compared to some place that's outside of immigration and customs checkpoints. And so there may be also some that go through irregular entry points without fully understanding that they need to go to those specific locations to try and claim asylum. But we're seeing it's really both those that are going to the ports of entry and those that are going through irregular crossing zones that have been detained and have had children separated from them. And we have even seen lawsuits being brought from last year before this was a sort of formal policy to that effect.
On what grounds would lawsuits be filed here?
Yeah, there are a couple of dimensions where we see some legal concerns. In terms of federal immigration law, we have adopted and signed on to international legal treaties regarding the treatment of asylum seekers. One of the principles there is that we wouldn't be detaining asylum seekers because these are not to be treated as criminals before we've established whether they have legitimate grounds for asylum. So that's one aspect, is that we would be violating that legal principle that someone who's really seeking a refuge from torture or harm or violence is different than someone who is a criminal, and they should be treated differently, not placed in the same kind of detention environment as criminals. Another aspect relates also to the violation of children's rights. There have been even U.S. court cases establishing guidelines about the detention of children, and that all efforts should be made to keep children with their family members or with other guardians or relatives because of the child welfare implications in terms of long-term trauma, psychological damage, things like anxiety, depression that come not only from detention but from being separated from their family members.
Is that separation and detention, as far as we know, in violation of international law or of American law for that matter?
Yeah, so what we see in terms of the international law is we have several treaties that we've signed on to. First of all, just regarding detention, we see that we're not supposed to be detaining asylum seekers as a general principle, that this is really something we should avoid unless it's a last resort. And if we are detaining asylum seekers, it should be on a case-by-case basis rather than a sort of blanket policy of everybody who is crossing irregularly, which would be, you know, illegally, that we will automatically detain them or automatically prosecute them. So that's the first aspect that's in violation of international law. The second aspect is if we are detaining them, they should be in humane conditions that are not criminal-like or jail-like conditions. But what we see is a lot of the detention centers are either former prisons and former jails or have been set up by private prison corporations very much on the model of a prison-like facility. So that's yet another way that we're sort of out of compliance with international law and the way that we're detaining these individuals.
The Trump administration, Homeland Security officials, including Kirstjen Nielsen from Homeland Security, have said if you are an American kid and your parent or parents commit a crime, they end up going to jail, in effect, you are being separated from your parents. You go into a system. Eventually, hopefully, they find you a guardian. This, they say, is no different. The parents are committing a crime and crossing the border, and unfortunate as it may be, that leads to them being separated from their kids. Is that a valid analogy?
Again, I think the emphasis that we would want to place on the asylum seekers and those that are seeking some kind of refuge, because we know a lot of the families, for example, that are coming across the border in these high numbers, they're coming from what's called the Northern Triangle region of Central America, so Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. And they're often fleeing things like kidnapping, torture, forced extortion, all sorts of really extreme violence. So they would meet the definition of refugee status, or, you know, what the U.S. law would refer to as an asylum seeker. They're seeking that status. And for that reason, we would want to make a distinction from someone who's an American citizen who has perhaps, committed a crime, and therefore their children end up in the custody of the state. So these asylum seekers under international law and our own law, since we have implemented those treaties in our own 1980 Refugee Act, we should not be treating those who are seeking that kind of refuge from those conditions in the same way we would treat someone who had a traditional criminal violation in the U.S. criminal justice system.
Elise Cohen is with us. She's an assistant professor of political science at UW-Sheboygan and UW-Manitowoc. She's with us to talk about the Department of Homeland Security's policy of separating children from their parents when families cross the U.S. border illegally. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this policy? Tell us why you support it or not. What do you think we should be doing? Do you have questions for our guest? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about a Department of Homeland Security policy that, in effect, separates children from their families as they cross into the U.S. illegally. Our guest is Elise Cohen, assistant professor of political science at UW-Sheboygan and UW-Manitowoc. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest? What are your thoughts on this policy? What should be in place at the border when it comes especially to families with children? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email ideas@wpr.org. We'll go to your calls now. Steve is with us in Slinger. Steve, hi.
Hello. I guess my comment would be that something needs to be done about our border problem. And maybe if this would deter people from trying to come in, it would be worth it. I mean,
Steve, thanks for the call. So is this something, Elise, that, we've cracked down at the border, there's this risk of being prosecuted if you're caught, of being separated from your kids. Does this send a message that says, okay, don't try to come in here outside of normal procedures?
Yeah, that's a really great question that the caller raises, because I think it's really at the center of the logic of where this policy comes from. We know when it was first floated last year in about March or so of 2017, that was the logic that was being put forward. This is a way to be much more aggressive at enforcing border control, and this is something that might perhaps deter future potential illegal crossings. And so there's a couple of things on that. What we see when we have these in-depth interviews with the people that are crossing, especially the families, in those reports, is it doesn't seem that deterrence has much of an effect because of the circumstances they're fleeing. That's to say they're already so desperate that they're willing to endure and sacrifice whatever it takes, because especially those with children believe that they are trying to get their children to safety, and it's to preserve the lives and well-being of their children, which is why they are trying to safely take refuge in North America. The other aspect of that is kind of a legal dimension. We had a 2015 federal court ruling, a circuit court in D.C., that specifically said, from an Obama-era standpoint, that the idea of using detention to deter future potential illegal immigrants is illegal. So there could be a legality aspect around detaining immigrants, which means one could imagine a legal aspect of separating families from children to deter. And I'm thinking that that is one of the reasons we see this link to federal prosecutions of actually committing the crime of illegal entry, as a way the Trump administration may be kind of anticipating the legal challenges that will come and have come in the past, that deterrence really is not legally valid.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to Brian with us in Bloomer. Brian, hi.
Hello, this is Brian here, working in Bloomer, Wisconsin. Where can we start? Professor, you're doing a wonderful job. I would like to say that the United States and its CIA forces created the miserable conditions that occur in Guatemala, Honduras, Nicaragua. They finance these guerrilla wars. Archbishop Oscar Romero begged President Carter to not support the oligarchy down in El Salvador. Carter refused to listen to what Oscar Romero was begging for. And so from there, we've got our hand in the mix that turned these Central American countries into uninhabitable places.
Brian, thanks a lot for the call. At least Brian saying we have some culpability, making the case anyway that the United States has culpability in the current conditions in Central America that are driving people to flee there to here.
Yeah, that's another really important dimension of this. As I mentioned, a lot of these families are coming from the Northern Triangle countries, and the U.S. does have a foreign policy history of involvement in those countries. I think your caller was referring to some of our Cold War policies about containing communism, and one of those was directly related to one of the Northern Triangle countries, Honduras, which ended up being a staging ground for the U.S.-backed Contras, this sort of right-wing rebel group that was fighting the Sandinista government in Nicaragua. So as part of that U.S. foreign policy, we saw a tremendous influx of militarization and weapons, and the sort of structural conditions that have enabled the facilitation of violence in the region to this day. So there is some interesting ground to make for the U.S. bearing culpability, not only in the structural conditions of violence, but also because in the 90s we had some deportation policies that were sort of ill-advised. We didn't really address the root causes of the drug trafficking violence in that area, but ended up deporting a lot of criminals back to Central America that then established some of these gangs that we know infamously today, like MS-13 in El Salvador. And so we just sort of relocated the violence a bit more south, rather than addressing the root causes of that drug trafficking violence. I think the third aspect that's often made with U.S. culpability for this violence is just our massive export of firearms to Latin America in the past decades. And so there are some really interesting angles when you think about U.S. foreign policy involvement.
Brian, thanks for that call. We're talking to Elise Cohen, political scientist at UW-Sheboygan and UW-Manitowoc, looking at U.S. border policy, especially when it comes to separating children from their parents when they cross the border into the U.S. illegally. Back to your calls now. Nate is with us in Milwaukee. Nate, hi.
Hi. Thank you. I was going to say I don't agree with this policy. It sounds like, from what your guest said, we're actually treating people who try to legally claim refugee status as somehow criminals. And it reminds me of some of the things that the administration has said, attacking immigrants all over as somehow being bad and terrible. And I'll point to a Journal Sentinel article from May 8th this month in the Journal Sentinel, where a father and a business person that employed three people was deported when he tried showing up to traffic court to pay a ticket. And he had not had any contact with the legal system for years before that point, which means he was living generally a good, upright life in society here in Wisconsin, and we threw him out.
Nate, thanks a lot for that call. In our last few moments, Elise, can you connect this border policy, separating kids from families, with the wider issues of how the Trump administration has moved on asylum seekers and refugees?
Yeah, that's a great final point. I think this does connect with this concept of nativism, which is an intense opposition to immigrants or internal minorities on the basis that they're foreign and threatening. And I think this is one of those moments similar to the debates we had over resettling Syrian refugees during the election, that there's something about these migrants. They're not just people seeking refuge, but they're hostile foreign invaders coming to harm the real Americans. So I think it does come down to a large segment, or at least a significant segment of Americans today does tend to view migrants as something threatening based on fear and suspicion, sort of repeating some history moments that we've had with Catholics, Irish, Germans, Jews, those of Chinese and Japanese descent. So the historical context of nativism is a really great connection.
We'll leave it there for now. Elise, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks so much, Rob.
Elise Cohen is an assistant professor of political science at UW-Sheboygan and UW-Manitowoc. She joined us to talk about the Trump administration's policy that ultimately separates children from their parents after families cross the border into the country illegally.